chapter of 1 Samuel, but it is a dramatic one, and so hopefully it'll grow you as we look at this in terms of David's part of his glory. 1 Samuel chapter 25, verse 1, this is the reading of God's word. Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him. They buried him in his house at Ramah. Then David rose and went to the wilderness of Paran. And there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife, Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite. David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men. And David said to the young men, "Go up to Carmel and go up to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus you shall greet him. Peace be to you and peace be to your house. And peace be to all that you have. I hear that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did them no harm, and they missed nothing all the time they were in Carmel. Ask for your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David." When David's young men came, they said all this to Nabal in the name of David, and they waited. And Nabal answered David's servants, "Who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers, men who come from I do not know where?" So David's young men turned away and came back and told them all this. And David said to his men, "Every man strap on his sword." And every man of them strapped on his sword. David also strapped on his sword, and about 400 men went up after David, while 200 remained with the baggage. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, "Behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to greet our master, and he railed at them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we suffered no harm, and we did not miss anything when we were in the fields as long as we were with them. They were a wall to us, both by night and by day, all the while we were with them keeping the sheep. Now, therefore, know this and consider what you should do, for harm is determined against our master and against all his house, and he is such a worthless man that one cannot speak to him." Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves and 2 skins of wine and 5 sheep already prepared and 5 seahs of parched grain and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs and laid them on donkeys. And she said to her young man, "Go on before me. Behold, I come after you." But she did not tell her husband Nabal. And as she rode on the donkey and came down under cover of the mountain, behold, David and his men came down toward her, and she met them. Now David had said, "Surely in vain have I guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. God do so to the enemies of David, and more also, if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him." When Abigail saw David, she hurried and got down from the donkey, and fell before David on her face, and bowed to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, "On me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow, Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of the Lord whom you sent. Now then, my Lord, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from saving with your own hand, now then, let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be as Nabal. And now let this present that your servant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who follow my Lord. Please forgive the trespass of your servant, for the Lord will certainly make Because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil shall not be found in you so long as you live. If men rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be found in the bundle of the living in the care of the Lord your God. And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out from the hollow of his sling. And when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause, or for my Lord taking vengeance himself. And when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your servant. And David said to Abigail, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from avenging myself with my own hand. For as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has restrained me from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me, truly by morning there had not been left to Nabal so much as one nail." And David received from her hand what she had brought him. And he said to her, "Go up in peace to your house. See, I have obeyed your voice, and I have granted your petition." And Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast at his house, like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she told him nothing at all until the morning light. In the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, and he became as a stone. And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Lord who has avenged the insult I received at the hand of Nabal, and has kept back his servant from wrongdoing. The Lord has returned the evil of Nabal on his own head." Then David sent and spoke to Abigail to take her as his wife. When the servants of David came to Abigail at Carmel, they said to her, "David has sent us to you to take you to him as his wife." And she rose and bowed with her face to the ground and said, "Behold, your handmaid is a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord." And Abigail hurried and rose and mounted a donkey, and her 5 young women attended her. She followed the messengers of David and became his wife. David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and both of them became his wives. Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was of Gani. May God add his blessings to the reading of his book. There's an anecdotal story about Henry Ford. One day he hired an engineer to build generators for this new factory that he had built with innovative technology to create an assembly line to construct automobiles, to mass produce automobiles. And one day, the generator that this brilliant engineer invented stopped working. So Ford called in all kinds of repairmen. They tried to fix the generator, but none of them had any success. So Ford had no choice but to call the original engineer who created and designed these generators to come in and take a look. And after just a few hours of tinkering with these generators, he flipped a switch and they all came back online. They all started working again. When Ford got the bill, he was staggered by the cost. For just a couple of hours of work, this engineer had the audacity to bill Henry Ford $10,000. And so he went to the engineer and he said, how can you justify this bill? $10,000 for a couple hours of work? What are you thinking? And the engineer said this. He said, "Well, for tinkering with the generators, I'm only charging you $10. For knowing where to tinker, I'm charging you $9,990. Wisdom is knowing where to tinker. And this is why so many of us spend so much time, so much money, so much of our resources to gain wisdom, to tinker with our lives. We do this when we don't know what to do with our careers. We Maybe go to graduate school, we go to business school, we talk to colleagues, we find the people that we want to latch ourselves after, and we ask them to mentor us, we network, we buy books, we read, we spend time and energy to tinker with our careers. We do this also with our relationships. We tinker with our relationships. We talk to our friends. We read articles. We read books. We tinker with our health. I've been doing that lately. I've been tinkering with my health, figuring out how to lose weight, how to eat more healthy, a more healthy diet, how to improve my blood sugar levels. We tinker with our entertainment and our comfort and our leisure. How much time do we spend asking the question, where should we eat? We're constantly tinkering with what to do with our free time, how to find the most optimal enjoyment. But are we being wise? Do we know where we should be tinkering the most? Today's passage is about wisdom. And we meet two people who lack wisdom. Their names are Nabal and David. And what's clear in this passage is that Nabal and David are industrious, they're busy, they're hardworking, they're actually very intelligent, but they spend way too much time, way too much of their resources tinkering in all the wrong areas of their lives. And then we meet a person that stands out, Abigail. And Abigail is presented to us as an example of wisdom. This is a woman who knows where she needs to tinker the most, and she shows us how easy it is if we just want to turn away from our folly and to pursue true wisdom in our lives. So we're going to look at these three characters. We're going to look at Nabal, we're going to look at David, and we're going to look at Abigail, and we're going to learn about the nature of true wisdom. So that's the outline for today. We're going to look first at Nabal and his folly. Number two, we're going to look at David and his anger. And number three, we're going to look at Abigail and her wisdom. So first, let's take a look at Nabal's folly. We first meet this man named Nabal in verse 2. He's introduced to us as someone who is rich. And the Bible not only says that he's rich, it says that he's very rich. He's also harsh, and he also behaves badly. I think that he would fit in really well in Silicon Valley. Someone who is rich, who behaves badly, but who's insanely successful, and a lot of people really envy and covet. As the story develops, it stands out that the most important thing about Nabal, though, is not his wealth, or his bad attitude, or his toxic personality. That the thing that stands out the most about Nabal is how foolish he is. He is a fool. In fact, his name, Nabal, in Hebrew, literally means fool. It's a pretty unfortunate name. What was it that made Nabal so foolish? And it's really not that obvious. Because when we think of a fool, I don't know about you, but when I think of a fool, I think about someone who has made all kinds of huge mistakes in their life. I think about, have you guys seen that documentary about the professional athletes that all go bankrupt? That's what I think about. I think about professional athletes who make millions and millions of dollars, and before their career is over, they go bankrupt. Right? I think about people who are failures. I think about celebrities who destroy their lives. I think about people who look ridiculous. I think about losers. And one of the things that's clear about Nabal is that he is not a loser. He had it made. He was more than just wealthy. The Bible says he was very wealthy. He owned a huge business featuring a flock of 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. To give you some context, Job, who is one of the most wealthy people in the Bible, had 7,000 sheep. So he's not quite at the level of Job, but this is massive wealth. This is not just a white-collar, upper-class person. This is someone who has extraordinary wealth. And that's not all. Not only was wealthy, but he had a beautiful wife. And this was not just a trophy wife. She wasn't just beautiful on the outside. She was beautiful on the inside. This is a woman that loved her husband and who knew how to help him, and it helped him advance in his career. And if that's not all, we also know that Nabal was happy because he knew how to party. In fact, the one party that we see in the Bible describes his party this way. It says that he partied like a king. He ate like a king, and he partied like a king. He knew how to have fun. And then, if that weren't all enough, we also know that Nabal was famous. And how do we know that he was famous? Because if you read the rest of 1 Samuel, every time that Abigail appears, and you all heard at the end of the passage that Abigail ends up marrying David, but for the rest of the Bible, she's referred to as Nabal's widow. Which means that people in the ancient world knew Nabal. They knew him. He was famous. He was wealthy. He was successful. He was happy. Everybody in the ancient world wanted to be Nabal. If he lived today, I think he would have made the cover of Forbes. If he wrote a book on how to make money and find happiness, it would have easily been a bestseller. And so when the Bible characterizes Nabal as a fool, it's subverting our ideas about wisdom and folly. You see, we think that wisdom is the skill that we need to know how to live our best life. That's what we think wisdom is. But the Bible shows us that wisdom is something altogether different. The Bible characterizes wisdom as knowing how to love God and love our neighbors. The skill required to love God and love our neighbors, that is true wisdom in this area. Nabal fails miserably. Nabal may have been wealthy. He may have been happy. But he didn't love God. It's clear. And he did not love his neighbors. We see this in his interaction with David. David came to him as a friend. He was offering Nabal friendship. That's what's happening in the beginning of this passage. David is still on the run. He's still in exile. Saul, the king of Israel, is still trying to kill David. And so David's hiding and he's running and moving from place to place. And he and his 600 men find themselves in Carmel. And in Carmel, Nabal's shepherds happen to be tending their flock. And what David decides to do is to offer protection to Nabal's shepherds. They put themselves in harm's way to protect Nabal's men and to protect his goats and his sheep. They kept guard of Nabal's men and their flock day and night, one of the shepherds says in verse 16. And remarkably, in the ancient world, there was all kinds of robbers and foreign enemies and wild animals, all kinds of hazards that shepherds faced. Remarkably, the entire time that these shepherds were out in the field, not a single man, not a single goat, not a single sheep was lost under David's protection. And so he not only offered protection, but he enlarged Nabal's wealth. And so when David sent his men to Nabal, only 10 of them, he could have easily showed up with all 600, but he only sent 10 because he didn't want to threaten Nabal. He sent these messengers, and he sent them this message saying, "Peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all you have." When he said this message, this was not a sentimental message. David wasn't just offering well wishes. David was telling Nabal, "I'm offering you peace, and I paid for it by my blood, sweat, and tears. I put myself and my men in harm's way to make sure that you will experience peace." And so it should have been easy for Nabal to return David's kindness. This should have been a no-brainer. It was shearing season, which means that he was about to come into a financial windfall. This was the time of year where Nabal saw most of his wealth, most of his money. He had more than enough to spare. In fact, later in this passage, Abigail actually takes a gift of food to David, and Nabal doesn't even notice that it's gone. He doesn't even notice that it's missing. He has more than enough to spare. And if you think about what it would have cost Nabal to hire private security, like the kind of security that David offered, an army of 600 men, it would have cost him an enormous amount of money. But what's David asking? say, look, I devoted my resources to protecting you. Can you just buy us lunch? We'll call it even. This should have been so easy for a novel to do, to return this kindness, to accept David's friendship. But in a dramatic turn of events, novel throws David's kindness back in his face. Verse 10, he says, who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their master. So now he's not only saying no to David, he's insulting him on top of it. He's saying, David, you call yourself a potential king, a rival to the throne of Israel. You're just a runaway slave. Go back to your master. Go back to your master Saul. Why would I help you? Why would I want to be friends with you, David? Why would I want kindness from someone like you? You're nobody. You're a runaway slave. How dare you offer me friendship? You see, Nabal had zero skill in loving his neighbors. When offered the friendship of a neighbor who was honorable, who was honest, who actually offered him kindness, Nabal didn't know how to receive it, he didn't know how to return it. Because Nabal saw everyone through the lens of inferiority and superiority. And when he looked at David, he saw someone who's inferior, someone unworthy of the friendship and kindness and respect that he was asking for. And this is folly. Looking down on other people is utter and absolute folly. And it's important for us to sit here and think for a moment. Are there people that you look down on in your life? We all have them, right? Some of us might look down on people who have moral flaws or are morally broken. I talked to a friend recently who's engaged to someone who comes from a very broken family, and his parents are really upset because they don't want a daughter-in-law who comes from a broken family. We all have ways of looking down on people. Maybe you look down on people at work who are not as competent as you are, or you look down on people who are not as hardworking as you are, or maybe you look down on people who don't have the social skills that you have and who are socially awkward. We all look down on people in one way or another, but it's folly. It's utter and complete folly, and the reason why is because everything that we have doesn't come from us, it comes from God. We can't take credit for any of the things that we do well, because even the things that we do well, even the ability to work hard, and even the ability to be competent at our jobs, all these things have come from God. There's this scene in the 90s movie, Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion. And Romy and Michelle are these ditzy women who go to their 10-year reunion against their better judgment, and they haven't really amounted to much, and they desperately want the admiration of their old high school friends, and they especially want to impress and thumb their noses at the people who bullied them in high school. And so they decide to make up this story that they invented Post-its. They figure no one really knows how Post-its were invented, so we're going to tell people that we are the people who invented Post-its. And for a while, it works. People are amazed, and they're shocked. You invented Post-its. You must be the most successful people in our class. And then they go to the popular group, and when the popular group finds out what they've done, they thumb their noses at them. They get their revenge. But then at a pivotal moment in this reunion, another classmate who went to business school and who did a case study on the inventor of Post-its announces to everyone that Post-its were invented by a man named Art Fry. And they're exposed. And suddenly, they become laughing stocks of the reunion. They look ridiculous because why? They took credit for someone else's work. And don't you see? When we look down on other people, that's what we're doing. When you look down on someone, you're taking credit for something that you have no right to take credit for. Because everything that we have came from God. Nabal didn't know how to do this. He didn't know how to love his neighbors because he didn't know how to love his God, and the two always intersect. Listen to what he says in verse 11. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men who come from I do not know where? What's he saying? He's saying, this is all mine. I built this. I did this. Why should not all took credit for all the good things in his life, but the truth is, even all these things came from God. Nabal's health, his skill, his relationships, his intelligence, his business opportunities, his servants, everything that he had came from God. In fact, in this passage, he says, I killed this meat, and everybody knows he didn't kill that meat. His servants probably did it, right? He didn't even do that, but he tried to take credit for the things that his servants did. God deserved the credit for all Nabal's success. Sometimes we're tempted to look down on people, but it's folly. Because if you truly believe that everything that you have comes from God, if you truly believe that every blessing, every good thing in your life that you've ever been able to enjoy comes from a creator who is all-powerful and all-good and all-loving and who is holy, if you believe this, then you cannot possibly think that you're better than anyone else. You cannot possibly look down on anyone else. When you give credit to God, it will humble you. It will make you more appreciative of the people around you. It will make you more generous with your time and your resources. It will make you more generous with your attitude, more patient, more gracious, more forgiving. If you find that it's hard to respect certain people in your life, if you find that it's hard not to look down on certain people in your life, then it's a good chance that it's because you have a hard time giving God credit for these things in your life. So, Nabal is a fool, and it's counterintuitive. His folly is different from the kind of folly that we usually fear. And the wisdom that he lacks is different from the kind of wisdom that we normally want. Brings us to the second part of today's sermon, David's anger. David is also a fool in today's passage. He's not wise, actually. And it's just a different kind of folly. When David heard what Nabal said through his messengers, he became outraged. And he immediately told his men to strap on their swords. And that could only mean one thing. They were going to go to war. David and his 400, he was going to leave 200 soldiers behind to protect their belongings, to protect their money and their food. And then he's going to take 400 soldiers to slaughter Nabal's house. And just in case his men were confused about the mission, David told them that they were going to kill every single man in Nabal's home. And this means not only Nabal, not only his family, but also all of his servants and even guests that were staying there who were passing through. It was going to be a massacre. And if David went through with this, he would have turned, and in this moment, he would have turned into one of the most reprehensible and evil people in the Bible. Why was David so angry? Well, David explains his anger in verse 21. Listen to what he says. David says, "Surely in vain I have guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him. And he has returned me evil for good. God do so to the enemies of David, and more also, if by morning I lose so much as one male of all that belonged to him." You hear what he's saying? The reason why David was so angry was because his kindness did it work. That's what he's saying. David's saying is, I showed this man so much kindness. I put myself out there. I took a loss to protect him and to make him rich. I didn't have to do that. I showed him kindness. And this is how he repays me. And when David thought about how his kindness was returned with insult, it just drove him crazy. Doesn't it make you angry when your kindness doesn't work? Has that ever happened in your life where you've shown someone kindness and instead of paying back with kindness, you got thrown under the bus, or you got slammed, or you got abused, or you got ignored, you got criticized? Maybe you answer a rude comment with kindness, but instead of offering an apology, the person just gets ruder. Or maybe you bend over backwards to help someone, but when you ask them for help, they can never seem to find the time. time, they will not lift a finger to help you. Or maybe every time your friend reaches out to you, you clear your schedule for them. But every time you ask them to hang out, it looks like they're too booked, they're too busy for you. Or maybe you offer your trust and loyalty to someone and then they betray you. Or you offer forgiveness to someone who refuses to admit that they did anything wrong. Doesn't it make you angry? When you show someone kindness and they repay it with hurt, with offense, with rudeness, it's hard not to get angry when we're punished for our kindness instead of being rewarded for our kindness. But it's folly. Getting angry with people who punish us for our kindness is folly. Why? Because kindness is no longer kindness when it is conditional. I will scratch your back if you scratch my back. That's not kindness. That's fairness. Kindness and fairness are two different things. And the reason why we are angry is because we're looking for fairness, not kindness. Kindness says, I'm going to be nice to you for your benefit, not my benefit. So even if you're mean to me, even if you hurt me, even if you're rude to me, even if you don't accept my kindness, I'm going to give it to you anyway. Because kindness is unconditional. Kindness is unfair. When we turn kindness into fairness, we lose kindness altogether. See, fairness isn't kind. Fairness demands justice and requires punishment. Fairness can't be sentimental. And so David was angry because he was seeking fairness, not kindness. Think of the people that make you angry. Think of the people who hurt you, the people that you can't trust. The people who have rewarded your kindness with hurt and punishment. And ask yourself, do I even know how to be kind at all, or do I only know how to be fair? David used to know how to pursue kindness instead of fairness. In fact, if you were here last week, just one chapter earlier, in chapter 24, he demonstrated extraordinary kindness. Because in 1 Samuel chapter 24, David had the opportunity to kill King Saul, a man who had made multiple attempts on his life, and who was at that moment hunting him down to put him to death. And it would have been fair. Everyone would have agreed that it would have been fair for David to kill Saul in that moment. It was self-defense. But instead of pursuing fairness, David pursued kindness, and he spared Saul's life and humbled himself before Saul and offered reconciliation to him. Suddenly, in the space of one chapter, David is completely different. Nabal didn't make multiple attempts on David's life. He just insulted him, and the mere insult triggered David so much that he was ready to massacre Nabal's entire house. What happened between chapter 24 and chapter 25? This brings us to the third part of today's passage, Abigail. Abigail will explain to us what happened to David between these two events and why he changed. Chapter 25 starts with a out-of-place sentence. I don't know if you caught it, or maybe you even forgot that it was there, because it's so out of place. In verse 1, it says, "Now Samuel died." Now Samuel died. The rest of the story in chapter 25 seems to have nothing to do with this sentence, but it has everything to do with it. Because Samuel was the man who first anointed David in chapter 16. Do you remember what he said that time? Pastor Rich preached an amazing sermon about this, about misdirection and how God doesn't look at what we look at. And what Samuel said to David's father, Jesse, was the Lord sees, not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. And it was this prophet who taught David how to trust God. That he had a God in heaven who loved him, who didn't measure David's worth based on who he was or what he had done or what he possessed, but loved him in spite of all of it, simply because he saw David for who he was. Samuel was also a prophet, which means that he was the voice of God. He was the voice of reason in David's life. He was the source of David's wisdom. And it's not a coincidence that right after Samuel dies, David suddenly starts to lose control of his rage. David starts to unravel the moment Samuel dies. You see, wisdom is not something that you either have or don't have. That's another misunderstanding that we have of wisdom. We think there are wise people and foolish people. But you know what David shows us, and I love this about the Bible, how real it is about the brokenness of human beings. Wisdom is not something that you either have or don't have. Wisdom is something that everyone needs all the time. And if you're not always getting it, your default will always be toward folly. And so here's the question. Who is speaking wisdom in your life? Is there anyone who speaks wisdom in your life on a regular basis? Do you give people a hunting license where you tell them, you know, I need some feedback. I need some real talk. I need some honest insight. Where do I need to grow? What are my shortcomings? Where am I being foolish? Help me. Help me to gain wisdom. David lost that when he lost Samuel, and it unraveled his life. And so it's an incredible grace that God introduces Abigail in this moment. Abigail steps in to this wisdom vacuum. And the Bible describes her to us as discerning and beautiful. And in Hebrew, word order matters a lot. She was discerning first, and then beautiful second. What mattered most to Abigail, and what mattered most about Abigail, was her wisdom, her discernment. She understood how to love God. She understood how to love her neighbors. Her beauty, her wealth, all the good things that she enjoyed in life from being married to a wealthy and powerful and famous man, all those things were secondary. They came to a distant second compared to her love for God and her love for people. Abigail valued wisdom more than she valued her beauty. And so when Abigail heard what David did for Nabal, how he protected Nabal's men and his flock and his business and how he enriched them, and when she heard what Nabal did, how Nabal sent his servants away insulting them and insulting David, she immediately took action to make it right. And look at the first thing that she does. The first thing that Abigail does is she sends a gift to David. She took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep, 35 quarts of grains, 100 clusters of raisins, 200 fig cakes, and then she ordered one of Nabal's shepherds to take the gifts to David ahead of her. This sounds like a lot of money, but keep in mind that David has 600 men, so this is actually just lunch. She bought him lunch, exactly what he was asking for. But it was nevertheless a demonstration of goodwill. And it was a gift. And notice that she sent the gift ahead of her apology. She sent the gift, and the gift would arrive before she arrived. The gift would arrive before she apologized. And do you see what Abigail's doing? She's showing David, this is yours. This food is yours. No matter what happens here, it's yours for you to enjoy. If you decide you don't want to accept my apology, enjoy the food. If you accept that you want to just go march and destroy my house and kill all the men, they might enjoy the food. You see what she's doing? She's setting David's expectations, and she's showing him grace. This is an act of unconditional grace. Receive these gifts, then hear my apology. It's not conditional. And then, when she arrives, she doesn't just let the gifts speak for themselves, she apologizes. And there's a lesson here, men. Some of you, you know, may send flowers to your wives or chocolate to your wives, but an apology is still necessary. Right? The gifts don't speak for themselves. She goes and she apologizes. And listen to her apologies. It's a remarkable apology. The moment she sees David, she runs to him. She's riding on the donkey, but she gets off the donkey and she sprints to David. She throws herself on the ground. She bows into the dirt, and then she says, "On me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant incredible thing about this apology is that Abigail is actually the most guiltless and innocent person in this story. What did she actually have to apologize for? Nothing, really, if you think about it. She wasn't even there when David's men spoke to Nabal. And so by apologizing, Abigail was taking credit for Nabal's sin, which is incredible. What makes it even more incredible is that David was marching to kill her house. He was the one that should have been apologizing to Abigail, but Abigail was wise. She understood that she was no better than either Nabal or David. Even though she was righteous, even though she was wise, even though she knew how to love God and love her neighbors, she didn't hold it against David or Nabal because they didn't. She showed them incredible kindness and incredible good grace. And she did this because she knew the Lord. So listen to what she does next. After apologizing, Abigail turns David's attention to the Lord and to all God's grace and all God's blessings. Verses 28 through 31, she says, "Please forgive the trespass of your servant, for the Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord. And evil shall not be found in you so long as you live. If men rise up to pursue you and seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living in the care of the Lord your God. And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause, or for my Lord taking vengeance himself. And when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your servant." Abigail doesn't rebuke David for his lack of faith. She doesn't say, "David, you're such a disappointment. You call yourself the future king of Israel. Show some faith. Show some character. Show some maturity. They call you the man after God's own heart. What a joke." She doesn't do that. She could have easily just torn David down here, but she doesn't do that. What does she do? She encourages David to see God's grace, to see God's provision, to see God's blessings. And what she's saying is, she's saying, "David, remember how much God loves you. Have you forgotten? Have you forgotten that you're loved by God? Look at how blessed you are already. God is just. God hates everything that is making your life hard, everything that is making your life painful. God hates these things more than you do, and he's going to make everything right one day. Don't lose hope now. Don't take matters into your own hands. Think about what you're about to do. God is going to take care of you. God's going to meet all your needs. He's not going to let you starve. Trust him. He loves you." And God uses Abigail. He uses her wisdom to melt David's heart. And David has a sudden turnaround. He's literally one moment saying, "We are not going to leave a single man standing in Nabal's family, in Nabal's house." And the very next he's saying, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion. Blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from avenging myself with my own hand. For surely as the Lord, the God of Israel lives, who has restrained me from hurting you unless you had hurried and come to meet me, truly by morning there had not been left in Nabal so much as one male. Go up in peace to your house. See, I have obeyed your voice, and I have granted your petition." It was a bleak situation. The hostility between David and Nabal looked insurmountable. The idea that one wise woman with a speech could broker peace between David and Nabal would have sounded ridiculous, but the foolishness of God is wiser than men. The weakness of God is stronger than men. You see, Abigail and David, and the wisdom that we see demonstrated in this passage, they point us to the true source of wisdom. Where does true wisdom come from? It doesn't come from inner fortitude. It doesn't come from discipline. It doesn't come from intelligence. It doesn't come from a lifetime of making all the right from a gracious God and a faithful Savior. Wisdom comes from Jesus. There's a scene in Matthew chapter 26. Jesus is being arrested by soldiers holding swords and clubs. And one of Jesus' disciples happens to have a sword himself, so he pulls out the sword and he cuts off the ear of one of the priest's servants. And do you know what Jesus said in that moment? This is Matthew 26, verses 52 to 54. Jesus says, "Put your sword back into its place. For all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels?" You see, Jesus gives us an altogether different kind of wisdom. The wisdom of the gospel is counterintuitive. Because if you have a holy God, then it only makes sense that God would demand that people be holy also and punish people when they fail to be holy. And that's one of the forms of wisdom that we have in life. We tinker with our lives to try to help ourselves become better people, to become more moral, to become more pious, to become more holy. And we think that if we do enough, if we become good enough, God will finally accept us. We need more wisdom to be more holy, but that's not the kind of wisdom that Jesus demonstrates for us or offers us. Or you might say that if people are sinful and God is truly loving, he should just be more flexible about holiness. God should not get so wound up and worked up about how we're broken. He knows that we're broken, and so he should just accept us for who we are. And there's no reason for us to change who you are. Just love yourself. But that is also not the kind of wisdom that Jesus presents us. The kind of wisdom that Jesus presents us is the wisdom of the cross. And what is the wisdom of the cross? The wisdom of the cross is God is holy, we are not, and therefore, because God loves us, he will take the punishment that we deserve. He will take credit for our sin. He will take credit for our brokenness. And friends, this is wisdom that no human being could have imagined or created or invented in millions upon millions of years. Who could ever imagine that an all-powerful and all-holy God would throw his life away willingly, suffer the humiliation and excruciating death of the cross, and bear the infinite wrath in order to love and deliver fools? The cross is folly. It sounds like foolishness. It sounds ridiculous. It sounds too good to be true. But this is the wisdom that Jesus gives us, and it is powerful to melt your heart, to reduce you, to make you humble, and to make you more generous. Abigail won David over with his wisdom, but she couldn't win over her husband. One of the curious things about this passage is that Abigail openly calls her husband a fool. And she points out, his name is fool. Can you really blame him for being so foolish? His parents named him fool. And when I first read this, I thought, Abigail must hate her husband. But when I read more closely, it's pretty clear that she loves him. And you know how I know she loves him? Because, number one, she calls him fool, but then she goes back to him. She could have easily gone to David and said, "David, I'm finished with this fool. You know, spare me, do what you want with him." She could have done, but that's not what she did. She said, "I know my husband's a fool. I know he doesn't know how to love God. I know he doesn't know how to love his neighbors. I know he overvalues his wealth and his success, and he undervalues his faith. Please just forgive me. Blame me." And then she goes back to him. And then look at the kindness she shows him, because he's partied like a king, he's drunk. And so she waits. She lets him sleep it off. And then in the morning she explains to him what she did. Why did she do this? Not to throw it in his face, but to love him and to offer him an opportunity to that you would be overwhelmed with humility and gratitude. But instead, novel literally is so stubborn and so proud that the moment he hears what Abigail did, his heart stops. Some scholars think that he may have had a stroke at this point, and then 10 days later,